On commence vraiment à entrer dans le vif du sujet, puisque le prochain panel a pour titre les politiques réglementaires. So we're going to get into the meat of the issue, policy, regulatory policies. And chairing this panel will be our policy guru, Marc Raboy. Marc Raboy est titulaire de la chaire Beaverbrook. Attendez que je lise tout ça dans le long parce que c'est un long titre. La chaire Beaverbrook en éthique, médias et communication et directeur de Media at McGill. Donc, il va nous présenter les panélistes et nous garder dans l'horaire.
Merci, Colette. It's really interesting to be following the previous session with a session on regulatory policies, because as I was listening to the speakers in the previous session, it struck me how so many of the success stories that we have in Canadian media are closely tied to successful regulatory policies. I mean, the example of APTN is a brilliant one. The fact that we have public funding for institutions and the crisis of public funding in the CBC right now, you know, reminds us that it can actually be different with smart policy. If I may, I just want to give one little reminiscence about something to do with regulation. And in this room, a couple of years ago, we had the great pleasure of receiving the late Pierre Junot, who was the founding director of the CRTC and actually, you know, the person most closely connected to one of Canada's most famous regulatory policies, Canadian content regulation. And Pierre Junot told the story at the time of how when he came in to the CRTC and he announced that he was going to bring in Canadian content regulation, there was a whole lineup outside his door of radio and television owners, each one coming in and telling him that they would absolutely be forced to go out of business if he dared do such a thing. And sitting here some 30 years later, he said, and you know, every one of them is a billionaire today. So there are many ways and many facets to regulatory policy. We're going to have three very different presentations here today, and I think happily we have only three presenters on this panel, so we're going to have a good length of time to hear each of them and then have a question period. I've asked them each to limit themselves to 10 or 12 minutes in the initial round, and we'll take questions at the end. So we're going to start down at the far end of the table with Christopher Ali, and I'll present each of the panelists and their paper as they come up. So the first presenter will be Christopher Ali, who is a doctoral student at the Annenberg School for Communication, University of Pennsylvania, and his paper is entitled There's No Place Like Home, His paper is entitled Understanding Canadian Local Media Ecosystems, an International Comparative Approach. Chris.
Thank you very much. Can everyone hear me? All right. Nope. Yes? Okay, great. Thank you very much, Dr. Raboy. So the topic of my talk today is going to be local media ecologies in Canada, what we know about them, what we don't know about them, and how to bridge this gap. I'm starting from the observation that in recent years, the United States, United Kingdom, and Canada have all experienced to some degree a crisis of journalism, particularly at the local level. This crisis is often attributed to a combination of secular and cyclical changes to traditional local media, in particular the growing migration to digital media and the economic downturn. This is to say nothing of the authoritative crisis being experienced by the profession of journalism with the rise of the citizen journalist. Concern for the crisis of local journalism rests on the normative belief that local news and information is crucial to inform citizenry, to a public interest, and to the overall health of our democracy. And that's just a quote from this from a CRTC regulation about this. Well, each of these three countries has experienced a noted decline in local journalism, particularly by traditional sources, radio, television, newspapers. I suggest that where these three countries differ is in their regulatory approach to these challenges. More specifically, in the past 3 years, both the FCC in the United States and Ofcom in the United Kingdom have launched omnibus research projects to understand not only the health of broadcasters and newspapers, but to gauge the status of what is dubbed the local news ecosystem or the local media ecology. These reports, right there, strove to understand the various types of news and information and media outlets reaching disparate communities in recognition of the fact that consumers no longer look exclusively to traditional outlets for local news and information. In contrast, the Canadian approach has been somewhat circumscribed, directed primarily by the CRTC and focusing almost exclusively on broadcasting, while creating such projects as the Local Programming Improvement Fund and lending rhetorical support to the importance of local news and information. I suggest that Canada lags behind in its understanding of its local media ecosystems when compared to these two countries. Using the aforementioned reports as comparisons, I suggest that while the CRTC has attempted to bring attention to localism in recent years, such attempts are piecemeal without a comprehensive understanding of Canadian local media ecologies. More specifically, I argue that an assessment of local news and information ecosystems akin to those undertaken by the FCC and Ofcom is needed, but from a distinctly Canadian perspective, incorporating the unique relationship to the local and domestic challenges facing local news production. I ask, therefore, what Canada can learn from these two studies and how might certain characteristics be adapted to suit the Canadian media landscape. Interestingly, this is actually not a new suggestion. In fact, a 2011 article in the trade magazine Wire Report ran the headline, "Canadian Broadcasters Can Take Lessons from FCC Report on Local News, Critics Say." The article, however, focuses only on broadcasting, and what I want to suggest to you today is that a comprehensive study needs to take a more holistic perspective. To address this problematic, I will examine three themes shared by the US and UK reports and explicate how these themes have been addressed in Canada and where any dearth of knowledge resides. As such, I'm going to discuss one, how these studies identify and define localism and the various related concepts, two, the holistic approach taken by researchers towards media platforms, and three, the players identified as key stakeholders in reviving the supposed paucity of local news and information. Before getting into these, however, I want to start with a discussion of Canada's historical treatment of the concept of localism in media policy. Localism articulates the relationship between a broadcast licensee and a specific geographic community. Unlike the US, however, in Canada, localism has generally taken a backseat to nationalism with respect to media policy. That said, there have been attempts to bring local to the fore in recent years. As we've heard before, the 1991 Broadcasting Act, for instance, makes several references to local, regional, and community broadcasting. And more recently, the CRTC has given rhetorical praise to the importance of localism and local news and information, calling it the cornerstone of the industry and one of the major building blocks of the community and of the broadcasting system. The CRTC has also implemented the Local Programming Improvement Fund, which began in 2008-2009, to assist in the provision of local news in small markets. Notwithstanding these developments, two issues continue to plague a dedicated push towards Canadian localism. As the 2003 Lincoln Report noted, Canada still lacks coherent localism strategy and policy. Additionally, according to the Lincoln Report, there is an absence of a common understanding of key terms and the bewildering array of policies that the CRTC has developed over time. The second issue is the Commission's approach to digital media, specifically at the local level. Despite acknowledging that Canadians are increasingly relying on digital platforms to access local news, the CRTC has yet to commission a study that assesses both traditional and digital local media platforms equally. Moving on now, in reviewing the US and UK local media reports, I suggest that despite their flaws, and there are, of course, a couple of flaws, Canada has a lot to learn from them. The first theme is that of definitions. In particular, both the FCC and Ofcom pay attention to defining and delineating local from community, regional, and national. As I mentioned before, this is a challenge. This remains a challenge for the Canadian regulator. Moreover, while both the US and UK reports note the difficulty in defining local in a digital age, they delineate their focus as being centered around some element of geographic localism. As such, the US report outlines four types of local news and information: hyperlocal, local, national, and international, while the UK report notes five: ultra-local, local, regional, national, and UK. Like the US and UK, Canada has traditionally relied on a geographic definition for its approach to community, local, and regional media. As I previously noted, however, Canada has historically struggled with defining and integrating these concepts. What exists at the moment is an amalgam of disparate terms spread across numerous regulatory initiatives. And I will add here as well that I attended the opening day of the LPIF hearings at the CRTC on Monday, and one of the central questions coming out of at least the first day was, how are we going to define what is local news and local programming? Moreover, and perhaps more importantly, an in-depth conversation about the value of these terms is needed. This is particularly true of the term region, given Canada's distinct geographic and demographic composition and historic tensions over regionalism. For instance, is the Canadian media system best served by policies directed towards localism, regionalism, or a combination? The Lincoln Report, taking note of this question, added, part of the problem with the term regional is that one person's regional can be someone else's local, regional, or provincial, depending on one's location, and it can be all three. I suggest that these issues have served to weaken localism policies in Canada through regulatory ambiguity. Whatever definitional direction is taken, we may conclude, however, that a conversation within media policy in Canada about the place of localism and regionalism is both severely lacking and desperately needed in a digital age. While underscoring the necessities of definitions, the US and UK local media reports also underpin the importance of examining local media from a holistic perspective. And this is the second theme of these reports. This is to say, not concentrating on one particular medium, but to focus on the multitude of media platforms that comprise a community's local news and information ecosystem. It was argued, moreover, that while neither the FCC nor Ofcom have regulatory jurisdiction over newspapers, mobile apps, or websites, failing to understand these media in an era of convergence does future regulation a disservice. This is a perspective the CRTC has lacked. That said, there is precedence within Canadian media policy to support the argument made here for a holistic study. For instance, the 2008 Diversity of Voices report discussed newspapers and broadcasting. The 1982 Applebaum-Haber report had a multimedia mandate, as did the 1970 Davy Committee and 1951 Massey Commission. As such, it would not be out of place for a study to incorporate media not regulated by the CRTC. The final theme is identifying key players in the provision of local news and information. And here, while acknowledging the contributions of the private and public sectors, both the US and UK reports overwhelmingly look to the private sector to correct the dearth of what the FCC report calls local accountability reporting. It is clear that any Canadian iteration would have to consider which sector or which combination would be best suited to advance media localism. While the FCC and Ofcom seem determined to anoint the private sector and the commercial sector as the bastions of localism, the Canadian context may demur. The CBC, for instance, released its Everyone, Every Way five-year strategy, which recommitted itself to the goals of local and regional news and information programming. That said, with the recently passed federal budget and cuts to the CBC, we don't know how this will impact the strategic plan. Not to be shut out, both BCE and Shaw pledged increased financial commitment to local news as a condition of their respective purchases of CTV and Global. The CRTC also has an important role in forwarding local news and information through the recently reviewed LPIF, designed to foster local news in non-metropolitan markets. As such, a discussion about local media ecologies in Canada needs to account for the many actors involved, including both incumbent and new entrants to the provision of local news and information, such as openfile.ca, or as we learned about this morning, the hyperlocal news initiatives of rural Ontario, the community media centres across the country, and as we will hear about in the next panel, hyperlocal news in Nova Scotia. To conclude, I have argued that Canada is in need of a comprehensive and holistic review of localism and local news and information ecologies. Moreover, through a comparison of recent FCC and Ofcom initiatives, I argue that three components are necessary for a distinctly Canadian review of local media. One, defining key terms. Two, a holistic approach. And three, identifying key stakeholders. The final aspect will be to consider which organizational body would conduct such a study. Canada has a rich history of royal commissions, standing committees, and CRTC-appointed task forces, all of which have undertaken key studies of the Canadian media landscape. However, since royal commissions are relatively scarce, I believe the question comes down to a decision between committee or task force. And I think, for one, a CRTC-appointed task force might breathe new life into this institution. Regardless of the definitional of the direction taken, what is certain is that as Canada moves forward into a digital 21st century, localism, regionalism, and local news and information cannot be left behind, and an understanding of their resonance and relevance is not only warranted but necessary. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Chris. And thank you for respecting the time without being reminded. It's always a pleasure for a moderator. So we'll move right along to Dr. Arne Hintz, who is a postdoctoral fellow in the Department of Art History and Communication Studies here at McGill, and his paper, I think, is still entitled Building Safe Havens for Future Journalism, International Initiatives for Media Policy Change.
Yeah, I could also change the title, actually, but we'll leave it like that for now. Do you hear me? Is the mic on? Yeah? Is it better now? Okay. Let's see how this goes. So what I'd like to do is to look at the issue of policy at the political and the legal environment of journalism from the perspective of civil society-based initiatives that seek to influence that environment. And so I'd like to do three things, actually. One, to explore what are the issues that they respond to. We talked a bit about funding in the previous session, and yeah? Okay. All right. So, really close. That's fine. Good. So, okay, three things. To explore the issues that these civil society initiatives respond to. Secondly, what is their understanding regarding the most important issues that need to be tackled in their perspectives, in their views? But also, thirdly, then, what are the strategies for influencing and changing policies? So it's not only going to be about content, but also like strategically, how do campaigns and advocacy groups actually how have they tried to influence policy? So the context maybe in thinking a little bit about this is, or the current context certainly, is that over the past few years we've seen a lot of turmoil in the field, the rise of citizen journalism, the troubles of traditional newspaper agency industry, we referred to that already today. Also the enthusiasm for new ICTs and social media, particularly following the Arab Spring, the WikiLeaks case and its implications for journalism, but also the many attempts to restrict and control free, particularly online communication by governments and businesses. There was a bit of a talk about that yesterday already. But we also see a third dynamic, which is, I think, civil society activism that responds to these challenges through advocacy campaigns and policy initiatives. And that's what I want to talk about a little bit here. But first, to start with, let's look at some of the obstacles and challenges that civil society campaigns respond to. And the first one that I would like to, or the first area that I would like to bring up here, is information control, which would include restrictions, of course, to public information by governments and other authorities, the problem of secrecy that WikiLeaks and others have highlighted, and then many current campaigns and initiatives on open data and freedom of information respond to. But it also includes private censorship through the use of libel and anti-defamation laws that allow, for example, companies to prevent critical and investigative reporting. It's a key challenge, I think, for journalism, particularly in some countries like the UK with its infamous libel laws. And of course, part of it would and also be the growing phenomenon of internet filters, not just in China and other usual suspects, but also in Europe and North America. A second area I think that is worth referring to would be access to infrastructure in a broadcast environment. We already talked quite a bit about that today. This would include transparent access to the airwaves for a broad range of media, including nonprofit, self-managed community broadcasting. In the online world, there is a debate, and we've probably all heard about it by now, on net neutrality and the emergence of network providers, but also app stores and others as potential gatekeepers that may actually be in the position to restrict news sources for political or economic reasons at the level of infrastructure. Third area would be surveillance, the trend towards systematic and ongoing retention of all data, but also trend towards data access or allowing data access by law enforcement without judicial oversight. There are the current debates in Canada around lawful access legislation. In Europe, there is the EU Data Retention Directive, but also we've seen the use of social media by governments to identify protesters and dissidents in Iran, in Tunisia, and not least in the US. Which is, of course, also a highly problematic area for journalism that requires confidential communication. And then there are further obstacles, such as critical resources, certainly funding, web space and online environments, and so on. We talked a bit about public funding, but increasingly we have also private actors that, such as Amazon, such as PayPal, and so on, that provide access to these services, to critical resources, and blocking that access is an important potential gatekeeping role and obstacle. And also this, I think, shows the increasing trend for internet intermediaries to be used to police the internet and to exert punishment. And then there are other areas such as excessive intellectual property protection. I don't want to talk too much more about that, and certainly questions of repression that are ongoing, the imprisonment of bloggers in the Arab region and elsewhere, but also imprisonment of whistleblowers such as Bradley Manning in the West. Now, in this presentation, well, let's go through these. And in this presentation, I just want to point to one initiative that responds to some of these challenges. In the paper and in other work, I've also discussed other examples, other cases. But here I want to choose, also in the interest of time, just one that relates perhaps most closely to questions of journalism, and that is the Icelandic Modern Media Initiative, IMI, which emerged in the context of the collapse of the Icelandic economy in 2008, with a goal to change the country's previous development model of being a safe haven for banks and for financial services, with a focus on secrecy and on restrictions to transparency, into a transparency haven and a favorable environment for media and investigative journalism. Actually, WikiLeaks activists played quite a big role in initiating it, and so did WikiLeaks' practice of using favorable legal environments in other countries to set up servers and route information through those countries. So the idea is to create such a safe haven in Iceland, and the practice has been to create a bundle of legal and regulatory proposals to, in their words, protect and strengthen modern freedom of expression. Now, what does that mean, modern freedom of expression? At the core of these proposals is the concern to prevent the suppression of content by private actors, mainly. So it includes regulations on limits to libel tourism and to strategic lawsuits and so on. In their words, they call this legal harassment. With the idea to protect national and international publishers from such content restrictions. So practically all information routed through the jurisdiction of Iceland would then be governed by this new set of laws and would therefore be maybe not entirely safe, but at least safer from censorship. It also includes a new Freedom of Information Act to enhance access to government-held information. So overall, it's a strong focus on information, on the area of information control that I brought up at the beginning. Furthermore, other aspects to this proposal, to this bundle of proposals, are that they include citizen journalists, publishers of blogs, civil society groups and all that in the remit of journalism. Also, they include the protection of whistleblowers, journalist sources of intermediaries, such as internet service providers. More recently, they've also started to become interested and active on the question of data retention, so on the surveillance aspect. IMI was adopted in principle by the Icelandic Parliament in June 2010, but the design of specific laws is still pending, or is ongoing, actually, and depends very much on the small core of IMI activists. But they're working on it, and actually they just put out a status report of their initiative a few days ago. Now, let's look at some of the strategies and practices that they have applied, which might be instructive also what advocates and campaigners are doing here in this country. The first area that I find interesting is what I would call legal hacking. Really what they did is they cherry-picked laws and regulations from other countries and assembled these tried and tested components as building blocks for their own legal package. So they took parts of, for example, the Belgian source protection law, the Norwegian Freedom of Information Act, the Swedish law on print regulation, the EU Privacy Directive, the so-called New York Libel Terrorism Act, and others. And what they did is they assembled, revised, and in a way upgraded these legal instruments towards something like perhaps we could call a new legal code. And it's no coincidence that I think we can use legal terms here because it's really a combination of a technological background, especially based on coming from the WikiLeaks activists that were involved in starting this, and a legalistic approach on the other side. Further aspect that perhaps could be interesting is the strategic use of policy windows and crises. policy window would be a temporary opening for affecting policy change. And so in Iceland, what we've seen, there was an economic crisis, there was a government change. The old political class, really also beyond the government, was temporarily delegitimized. Established practices and models were widely criticized. And so really, there was a window of opportunity to influence the political environment. Also, some interesting aspects could be perhaps a question of framing. Framing meaning to basically make one's objectives resonate with the ideas and perceptions of the target audience. And so, for example, here in our case, they really emphasize the need to create a new international reputation as a transparency haven, also following this older reputation of a safe haven for banks. And so in their initial proposal, they used words such as the need to engender the goodwill and respect of other nations to promote the nation's international standing and economy and so on. Frame their initiatives. And another aspect perhaps could be inside-outside connections within this particular or by this particular initiative. So the campaign member Birgitte Jonsdottir was actually elected as a parliamentarian and was really crucial in facilitating IMI's adoption in parliament. So what does this tell us? I think IMI highlights a number of current challenges and restrictions that I think are useful to look at, including private censorship through the use of libel and anti-defamation law, including the increasing role of intermediaries in censorship and control, including the vulnerability of whistleblowers and other sources, questions of access to information, now increasingly also state surveillance. They've also started to look more into the issue of net neutrality and so on and in further steps. And they combine all this under the term modern freedom of expression with the goal to make Iceland a safe haven. I think that has at least the potential to advance our understanding of necessary journalist freedoms by pointing to current control points in information flows, but also by showing the feasibility of actually creating protected territories for this. Just briefly, I think it also, as I said, it also shows us conditions and strategies for success that I briefly mentioned, like what I called legal hacking, use of policy windows, framing of alliance building, and so on. But perhaps it also shows us some of the gaps in this agenda that are worth discussing further on questions of infrastructure, on critical resources, on other issues that they're not focusing on so strongly. Perhaps it also shows us something regarding problems of some of the strategies that are applied, because there in that country, for example, we can see now how the policy window is already closing and which could create a new situation. Now the question on which aspects of this are relevant for Canada, I think that's maybe a good question to discuss later in our discussion. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, Arna. We'll move right along with the third presentation from Professor Paul Knox, who teaches at the School of Journalism, Ryerson University. And the title of his paper will be Informing Democracy: Access Strategies for Citizens and Journalists.
Okay, thank you very much. Like the last paper, how's this for sound? We're good for the sound? Like the last paper, I feel I'm a little bit here under false pretenses, because this is not totally about regulatory policies. It's also about a little bit about how you get there and what you can do without having to change laws and so on. But this is primarily what I'm going to suggest is that access to information, freedom of information, is an area in which has tremendous potential to bring people who are engaged in journalism. Notice the terminology. It's the SM ending, not the ST ending. As was alluded to earlier, I very, very much believe in this idea of acts of journalism rather than getting hung up on who is a journalist and who is not a journalist. But it has the potential to bring together people who are engaged in this kind of work and who believe that it is important for the future of our society and our world. I am not an access to information specialist. I was looking around for strategies because there was a call for strategies, and this is my response to that call. I did very early on in the life of access to information in Canada have an experience where I actually applied for a bunch of stuff, and I think my name is somewhere on a Federal Court of Appeal decision because the information commissioner at the time took it up, and we lost the appeal. And in fact, Jeff Sellett, who's in the audience here, had to stick handle this for me for a while because I took off and started to live in Mexico, and this thing was pending. But that's really my only experience. There are all kinds of people in Canada who are very good experts at getting information out of governments and writing stories about them. But I'm going to suggest some ways in which I think we could move this agenda forward and why it's important. Access to information, freedom of information, why do we place emphasis on it as journalists? Well, citizens need it because it helps inform choice. The more we know about our governments, the more we can make good political decisions. Journalists need it because it helps them do the accountability part of their job. Anybody who is engaged in journalism wants good access to government information, wants maximum access to it, because that's how you hold people accountable. Documents. A lot of what you get is documents, and documents, as any good historian knows, it's a lot harder for a document to lie or to twist the truth than it is for a person to twist the truth. Data portraits of our society. We get portraits of our society through the release of data. Secrecy, I argue, makes bad decisions, not just me that argue it. One of the foremost experts in Canadian and international access and access to information legislation, Alistair Roberts, has made this point. And finally, from a freedom of expression point of view, I see freedom of information as an essentialist extension of the right to freedom of expression that's enshrined in so many international legal instruments and in our Charter of Rights and Freedoms. You cannot formulate opinions, you cannot formulate good expression in a society without good access to information. Freedom of information and access to information requests have produced some of this country's greatest journalistic triumphs. Somalia, the misdeeds of Canadian peacekeepers in Somalia, police abuses, the sponsorship scandal, racial profiling, and most recently the robocall story have all utilized freedom of information or access to information requests. By the way, the federal legislation and some provincial laws are called Access to Information Acts. Most provincial and territorial laws are called Freedom of Information Acts, and the terms are generally used more or less interchangeably. We have had great success over the years with this legislation, which, by the way, the first one was passed in Nova Scotia in 1977. The Federal Act was passed in 1983. However, over the years, governments have realized that it has tremendous potential to embarrass them, particularly politicians, but also bureaucrats, and they've developed a huge array of measures to try and blunt the effect. Broader classes of exemptions from disclosure, long delays, huge fees. They circulate things for supposedly necessary consultations among other departments, which delay even further. They exempt large classes of records under the rubric of cabinet secrecy. They actually have lately begun to single out so-called accountability requests for information, the ones made by reporters and by civil society, NGOs, watchdog groups, for special treatment, which amounts effectively to harassment. They shut down the National Registry of information requests, which was a very, very useful tool. in, I believe it was 2008, and what I call open washing, which is the latest technique, which is we've seen from the Federal Treasury Board President Tony Clement, where he is making all these announcements about open data initiatives. Oh, hey, guess what, guys? We're going to put all this stuff up in the internet, and anybody who wants to can look at it. Well, the only thing is it's them who decides who what goes up. And in fact, it has nothing to do with documents. It's data sets that may or may not be the most relevant in any given case. Information commissioners, who are people in the federal and provincial governments who are effectively, they act like ombudspeople. They guide citizens. They're supposed to guide citizens through the process and take up appeals if government departments delay too far. Have begun to be very outspoken about some of these things. The Alberta outgoing Alberta commissioner last year, who said that these legislative exemptions were threatening to turn the legislation into a piece of Swiss cheese. The Quebec commissioner, who said recently that there was a culture of secrecy in the provincial government, that the law should be modified, the government should be more proactive, and the federal commissioner, who basically said the exercise of discretion has developed over the years to the extent that it is generally now skewed toward greater protection of information. Many people have fought back, and some of them, these include the information commissioners themselves. We have a tremendous number of people who do investigative reporting, who are information researchers, news organizations, trade organizations that have undertaken research, that do annual audits of requests and performance of governments, civil society groups such as the Open Government Coalition, which is spearheaded by Democracy Watch, the various open data initiatives to which there was some reference already here, open media, the Right to Know Coalition of Nova Scotia, and so on. And I guess my suggestion is that what we need is a lot greater understanding nationally of what everybody is doing and places that we can go to share information and share techniques and news about what happens. So my proposal is for an FOI portal that would have a number of sections. One would be a single place where you could go to see basic documents, laws, rulings, procedures, appeals, and so on, contact information, and so on. The second part would be an education section, a guide to request meeting, how to make requests under this legislation, sample letters, tips for pursuing them, for appeals, the theory, resources on the theory and the history of freedom of information. The third one would be data and tools section, available data sets, not just the ones the governments make available, but the ones that reporters and others pry out of them. There's a proliferation now of software that you can use not only to scrape data from the web, but also to analyze it. A news and events section, so that people could start talking to one another on a more systematic basis. A database section where we would actually post, if we could, the journalism that was produced by whomever, and some capability for real-time republication, tweeting, and so on, archived stories, links, commentary on the process, that kind of thing. And an international section as well, news about what goes on in other countries, because there is a lot, as the last presenter referred to, a lot going on in other countries, not just Iceland, but and some of the ones you might least expect. I mean, some of the best freedom of information, legislation, and procedures now are in places like Brazil, Turkey, Mexico, and so on. How do we support the FOI portal? Well, there would have to be support from a broad range of some of the places we've heard of already, for-profit journalism organizations, nonprofits, public alternative media. Journalism schools, I think, potentially have quite a role to play here. In fact, I think possibly this building on the wonderful model of JSource, which is a collaborative, most of you probably know as a collaborative portal of news generally about and resources generally about journalism. Building on that success, I think this could that could be a model. And in general, what I think this could do is actually pull together what I just loosely call here an FOI coalition. I also think this is an idea I came up with in the course of thinking about some of these things. How do you get people to buy in, and what can people concretely do? And I'm going to get to the regulatory stuff in a minute. But short of that, what can we actually do to use these tools to reinvigorate some energy into this wonderful instrument that, frankly, has been allowed to languish and slide a little bit into disuse because the other side has won some victories? I mean, it's tough to do this stuff. I've talked to people who do it. They say, you know what? We're tired. It's difficult. They pose too many obstacles. We're already dealing with shrinking newsroom resources and so on. This stuff is just getting harder and harder. Well, what do we do to reinvigorate the process? And my suggestion is that we think about asking people to take the FOI pledge. Everybody can do this. You say, we're going to make a sustained commitment to using freedom of information. We're going to get on top of it. We're going to set targets for the number of requests we make, set targets for the number of stories, pieces of journalism we want to appear during the course of a year. We're going to cover it as a beat. We're going to liaise with the portal. We're going to post whatever we get, and we're going to use our power to give it some publicity as well. If that were to happen, I think there would be a good basis then for some advocacy campaigns. In the regulatory area, without having to change laws, you can push people to do better on the release times, response times, and release times. Remove these obstacles. Shame them into removing some of the obstacles. Allow electronic request filing, which surprisingly is not very common in Canada, although it is in other countries. Standardized formats, which frankly most of the bureaucracy would love, because it's unbelievably difficult to find records now sometimes because you can't get the formats. And maybe some action on fees as well. On the legislative side, give the commissioners power to make orders and tell bureaucrats that they have to release the information that they're stalling on releasing. Some of them have it in some of the provinces. Ontario is one of them. British Columbia, I think, is another one. They don't federally, and they don't in the majority of the provinces. Require accountability, require politicians when they interfere with information requests, which they do and are allowed to do from time to time, to be accountable, to say why they're doing it. Tighten up on delays, extend freedom of information coverage to all public entities. There are some that are exempt now, such as some certain crown corporations. And move toward a situation where disclosure is routine rather than exceptional. And in that area, finally, constitutional reform. Very, very difficult, very touchy area in Canada. But to really get to the point where we need to be as a society, certainly as people who value and practice journalism within that society, we have to have respect constitutionally in the basic founding documents that govern us for what people have called the right to know, where disclosure is the default, where this information that is collected at public expense by the people that we choose to govern us is routinely disclosed unless the state can make a good case for not disclosing it. I mean, when you actually stand back and sort of go to 30,000 feet and look at this issue, this seems like a perfectly obvious thing that, you know, when you pay, when governments use tax money to collect information, I mean, there is no reason why it shouldn't be routinely, automatically made public. Sure, there are always going to have to be exemptions for certain reasons, such as personal privacy, but that can be dealt with. And in fact, it's never been easier to deal with it. We now have the tools to do this. We now have the technological tools to do this, and we should be moving And this, of course, is certainly medium and probably long term, but we certainly should be moving to this point where disclosure is the default rather than the exception, and rather than being something that you have to fight for. So to wrap up, I'm proposing that freedom of information and access to information, this whole area, is really ripe for the formulation of strategies that can help journalism do what it does best in the interests of our society. It can unite citizens, journalists, people who work for private media, public media, legacy media, mainstream, whatever you want to call it, alternative new forms, and so on. And unlike some of the discourse that we tend to hear now, in my paper I talk a little bit about how much rancor and jealousy there is around about people, from people who see themselves as threatened, or alternatively from people who see themselves as blocked in achieving the new things that they want to achieve. I think this is something that has maximum power, maximum potential to unite us rather than divide us, and that's what I would like to see. And I welcome your questions, and I thank once again the organizers for making this wonderful opportunity available to all of us. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, we've certainly had three interesting papers, each of them in their own way, on the importance of the legal regulatory framework in which journalism is practiced, the importance of understanding what it means and how it works, and ideas about advocating for change. I think we'll go directly to questions. Do they need to use a microphone, or is it just... Yeah, okay. Over here.
Okay. Hi, I'm Rana Al-Rabi. I have a question about... it's to all of you, but just the idea of the portal. I mean, kindly clarify if I didn't understand correctly, but if you concentrate everything in one portal, wouldn't it make it easier for government to shut it down? Mm-hmm. And just as a follow-up question, if any of you have any insight, you know, it's 2012, we have like a iPhone in our hand, but we still have censorship. Like, what explains that?
Paul?
Sure. Well, I mean, you know, I'm far from an expert in how you set these things up, but I understand that, you know, you can have mirror sites and, I mean, you can put it, just because it's one portal doesn't mean it's all in one place. I mean, you can, you know, you can, I mean, in fact, that's part of the lesson of WikiLeaks. I mean, I don't think this is, but we're not talking here about WikiLeaks. I'm not talking about anything that's particularly subversive. I'm just talking about... information sharing. I mean, I suppose theoretically we're at the level where the federal government could shut down a site because it was calling on people to use freedom of information legislation to access more government information. In practice, I hope that if that happened, it would inspire some action. So yeah, it's a good point, and I hadn't thought of it. But I mean, number one, that would be an enormous political issue. And number two, I mean, if governments actually did something effective in that area, and number two, I think that there are ways to protect yourself against it. Your question about the iPhone and
why do we still have censorship?
I guess I just, yeah. I don't understand. It's like we're reverting, you know, like
yeah.
We still have issues of censorship, and they almost seem scarier today.
Right.
But we have all this advanced stuff. Like, what explains that?
Well, I think, I'll be brief. I'll try to be brief anyway. I mean, I think, number one, in all these debates about not only this topic, but the future of journalism. I mean, I think there's a danger in losing sight of the fact that more people have access to more different voices and more information today than at any time in human history. I mean, it's really easy. It's too easy to lose sight of that fact. And we, you know, we should rejoice in that and remember that that horse has left the barn. That, you know, that's not going to change. And, you know, when I think of the job I used to do and trying to do it even 30 years ago, it was exponentially, the access to information that we have has become exponentially greater. The fact, and that's true of government-held information in Canada. I mean, it's easier to get certain types of information now. It's easier to find out, you know, what kind of dogs are licensed in your own municipality now than it ever used to be. That's the sort of thing they do put up on the internet. And, you know, it's easier to get property tax information. It's easier to get information about municipal assessments and stuff like that than it ever used to be. And I think it's precisely for that reason. It's precisely because there's so much available that, you know, governments who and politicians, elected people, officials who are supposed to be accountable, realize that the genie is out of the bottle and that it poses, in certain areas, a danger to them. And that's why we're seeing this pushback from them. We're seeing these measures put into place to actually, to impede the flow of information. I guess what I'm arguing is, there are things that can be done about that. There are things that when people get together and actually set up mechanisms to, you know, make concerted efforts to oppose that kind of thing and to publicize it when it happens and to do coordinated analysis and advocacy around it. It's just nobody ever said it was going to be easy, but, I think it would go a long way to counteract that kind of thing. The final thing I'll say is, I was talking to somebody about this last night. I mean, I was at a Newspapers Canada convention conference a couple of years ago, and somebody made a presentation about mobile applications for news, and told a story of a news organization in Italy that relied on Apple for its is a tabloid and relied on Apple for its. Had an Apple application app for iPhones, and discovered one day that its front page was not available. Now this is kind of a Berlusconi Racy type tabloid, and they inquired of Apple what had happened. Was it some technical problem or something? And the word came back they had had a picture on the front page that apparently was the cause of the problem, and the message that came back was, Steve doesn't like nipples. If you think about that, and so what's happening is that a very high corporate level in that corporation, somebody's making decisions saying we don't want this, we don't want to be party to this content. So, iPhone, large corporations. If this was General Motors, if this was, Exxon, if this was Halliburton, if this was any one of a number of other huge international corporations, I mean, we would be outraged by this behavior. We'd be outraged by Zuckerberg and Facebook. We'd be outraged by, these attempts to use these to control information in this way, or to exert that kind of control on a global level. For some reason, because they're cool, because they're young, because these are tools that are, neat, that enable us to do many, many interesting things that we like to do, they get a free pass. And I don't think they should.
Can I get a sense of how many people want to ask questions? Okay. So we'll be fine. I'll take one in the back.
Yeah. Hi. My name is Alexandre. And, it's just kind of, to put it out there, I work for Open North, and we are a new Canadian nonprofit, and we develop apps that seek to make a democracy better. And so, for instance, we did a collaboration with the Gazette, was Gazette Docs, and in essence, what it did is that it went through all the PDFs from the Montreal Executive Council, where people would kind of give out contracts, and take that out and put it in a database. So now it's possible to kind of go through them, the types of contracts awarded, the companies awarded, the amounts awarded, the moments awarded, et cetera, et cetera. And we're actually going to Freedom of Information Portal. It's not going to come out yet. It's in the works, so it's around September, and we are going to base it on what has been done in the UK with the what do they know platform. And in essence, what that does is that you make a request through the website, and it's posted online. And so then everybody and the answers and the whole process is actually. So if it's a waiting reply or if it was it was not granted, well, then it's shown for everybody to see. Whereas, you know, when you have these one-on-ones, sometimes it's kind of hidden. So we're looking, you know, for some help maybe in the adaptation of this platform to the Canadian context and also on some educational aspects of how people can kind of, you know, jump in and whatnot. So it's kind of, and maybe if you have thoughts, I was thoughts on the other experiences around the world, and you know, if you had some maybe some caveats to for the importation of that.
Questions, and then we'll see. Okay, Bob Hackett.
Hi, sorry.
Hi. This one's for Arne particularly. Thanks for that excellent overview, Arne. And I'm just wondering if it's hopelessly 20th century of me to want to add to your list of policy issues, or do you think they really are falling off the agenda? Two issues. One is a positive role for the state in creating the conditions for democratic public discourse, which historically, you know, has theoretically been one of the roles of public broadcasting. And secondly, the whole question of media concentration and convergence, which, you know, in the Murdoch era seems as relevant as ever, given what's going on in the UK and elsewhere with the phone hacking and so on. So do you think those two issues are still relevant? Should they be on the list, or how do you feel about it?
Let's take one more question, and then we'll get answers to the three. Yes, over here.
Hi, my name is Marie-Ève, and I'm a vice president of LAGIC, l'Association des journalistes indépendants du Québec, which is a freelancer association here in Quebec. And I have a question. It's kind of funny to see unite, don't divide, because in the journalistic community, we really feel as freelancers that there is a division between the the journalist who works in newsroom and the journalist who works as freelancers, and the reality of both of them is so far apart in just to make a living that it's kind of hard to actually unite, and I feel like that we should we would gain a lot to unite, obviously, but that it's not impossible, but far to happen. Well, I would like to hear from you about this.
Okay, was that directed at
well,
one in particular?
Unite, don't divide. Yep. Yeah.
Okay, so we'll hold that. Arne, do you want to respond to?
Yeah, maybe just briefly. I mean, these are important points that didn't really feature prominently in what I was putting up here. But I think I would absolutely see them as part of it with regards to, for example, access to infrastructure. I mean, the question of what kind of media actors have access to the airwaves or to other resources and so on, the question of funding and so on, of course, has a key role for the state in terms of allocation, administration, and so on. And in other examples that I've looked at in my research, like, for example, like countries in Latin America and or the new community media laws and various other parts of the world, also South Asia and Africa and so on. It's of course a key question whether, for example, the community media that we talked about so much already today have access and are allocated parts of the radio frequency spectrum, and according to the new law in Argentina, there will actually be allocated 33% or one-third of the radio frequency spectrum. At least that's the principle on which this is based. And so there's a lot happening. Then the next question then also in these countries is, so what do you do with the actual monopolies and oligopolies of commercial media? And that then becomes a much more difficult question, because then you're up against the powers that be. And there is, I think, in some countries, for example, in Latin America, a lot of struggle at the moment and with uncertain outcomes. Yeah.
Okay. Paul, do you want to deal briefly,
sure.
please?
Sure. Yeah. Thrilled to hear about Open North and happy to talk about, some possibilities of, moving forward with that kind of thing. It's exactly the sort of thing I'm talking about. As far as freelancers versus staff people, I mean, I hope that this kind of initiative would, for example, one of the things that this would do, and I don't want to suggest that other people haven't worked on this, they have, but the more the better, is that it would actually make information available to freelance journalists that otherwise might not be available, otherwise it might be closely held in relatively well-resourced newsrooms by, staff people who had spent a long time acquiring this kind of expertise. Don't want to say that kind of thing doesn't exist now. It does. There are workshops and so on that one can go to. This would possibly make it a little bit easier.
Okay. Chris?
Yeah, I just want to comment on comment from Open North, which I also think is a really excellent idea. And I want to talk about a little bit of what you're saying about the education platform of it, because I think that's really important, because I think there's one thing to be able to do to want to have a freedom of information request, but then there's another completely other thing about how to do it and have the tools and have the skills, the digital and media literacy skills, to be able to do that. And I think that this also goes to the comment about censorship, which is the need for more media literacy, more digital literacy, to be able to kind of cull through documents, to be able to know what you're looking for, to kind of have those tools, and whether or not it's through formal secondary school, for instance, curriculum, or more kind of DIY wiki education, not only for freedom of information, but things like citizen journalism. And this is also a job we're seeing in the States being undertaken by community media centers. So what were once cable access television is now becoming kind of these community media centers, which we've heard about already. And one of their focuses has been on partnerships and strategic collaborations with other organizations to deliver kind of these educational platforms, media literacy and digital literacy, to give interested citizens the tools to be able to do this on their own.
Okay. We can take up to three more questions. I think I saw three hands before, but let me just verify who still has a question to ask. They've evaporated. There's one. Is that it? Okay. Go ahead.
Yeah, the question was for Dr. Hintz. I was just curious on the list of initiatives being undertaken in Iceland. Could you pick two or three that you think we could apply here or that we're close enough to try for?
That's a fantastic question. I was kind of hoping to hear more from all the experts here about this, because I think there are some interesting proposals there, but of course what they understand as modern freedom of expression means different things there than it means here or in other parts of the world. There are a few things that they've tackled to start with. And I'm just looking at this current report that came out a few days ago on aspects on source protection. Freedom of information was discussed already, and that's for them a priority, and it's certainly also a priority here. And other questions of libel, whistleblower protection, and so on is what they're working on. I mean, I think these all relate to some of the structure that I put out there in various ways. And it would actually be interesting to see what people here think would be the priorities actually for Canada. I don't know if anyone wants to reply
to the question from the panelists, but there is one more. We'll take one final question back there, and then unless anyone has anything really urgent to say, we'll move on after that.
Okay. Hi, my question is for Paul Knox. I'm just curious. I know your presentation wasn't specifically about WikiLeaks or anonymous hackers, but I'm just wondering what you think their effect is on freedom of information more globally. Do you think their effect is pernicious in the sense that it presents sort of ethic problems for journalists, but also it is sort of breaking down barriers that governments and other institutions have put up, and they actually have been able to get access to information that traditional freedom of information has so far not been able to. I'm just wondering if you think it's good or bad in terms of public access to information.
Well, I think the balance is good, and the balance is good for a couple of reasons. Number one, it demonstrated that the scope of the issue, how much information there is out there that governments are reluctant to part with. It also was a tremendous window on some of the things that governments do that perhaps those of us who are privileged enough to have been close to that kind of thing as journalists for a long time knew about, but the average person doesn't. I also think it was good because the dispute that arose between Julian Assange and the media organization, the large media organizations with whom he was collaborating, the collaboration that broke down, highlighted some of the difficulties that are posed by this kind of activity. We don't have time to go into what happened, but you know, the New York Times, the Guardian, the German, I think it was Der Spiegel in Germany, and they basically said, well, we have to do some checking on this. We can't just dump this stuff. The process kind of deteriorated for a number of reasons. And what that did, apart from the fact that it resulted in some, I think, pretty good journalism after the, you know, traditional techniques of verification and so on were applied, was it highlighted for the entire world how important it actually is to do that, and underscored, you know, the importance of, you know, you don't want to just sort of dump this stuff out there, because I mean there was stuff in there that could have directly led to, you know, for example, you know, civilian informants of military organizations being outed and targeted and killed. So I think, you know, I think it was good for a number of reasons. And in fact, I wrote some things about WikiLeaks and that kind of, and you know, discovered the Icelandic initiative, and that kind of led me to start to think about this kind of thing as perhaps something that could be, you know, could lead to some initiatives that would be crafted in Canada. And I absolutely think that, you know, that should be an inspiration. But I don't think that sort of, like, just sort of, you know, data dumps without, or document dumps without any sort of application of any kind of filter at all, you know, are likely to be a good thing. So, I mean, basically, I think the balance is quite positive.
Okay. Well, it's nice to end on a positive note. And we'll have a short break now and reconvene in 15 minutes for the next panel. Thank you very much.